Welcome to Scuderia F1, the podcast that's always up to speed with the latest Formula One news. Follow us on Twitter at Scuderia F1 Pod and subscribe to the show on iTunes and Stitcher. Now, here are your hosts, Mark Daly and Kevin Larame.
Good day, good night, and welcome to Scuderia F1, the podcast that is always up to speed with Formula One. We're going to review the Brazil Grand Prix today, Mark, but first of all, thank you to everyone who has voted for us in the number one podcast of Formula One, I guess, in the world, I guess. So that was pretty cool.
Yeah, that was pretty cool and somewhat unexpected. And that's really great news. We got a link up in our Twitter feed, I think also on our Facebook page. So thank you for everyone. It's nice to be recognized and somewhat humbling. So it's a nice moment. I mean, we put 3 long years of work into this podcast, and it feels good.
Yeah, we're in front of Behind the Grid, the actual Formula One. Like, we're in front of a podcast that has way more budget than we do. So it's always fun to beat the big guys.
Exactly. Well, considering we have no budget really to work with,
it's exactly that's what
we can say about the other 19 shows that are ahead of us on the list. But it's a great moment, and I know both of us are very happy about it. And it's just big thanks for the listeners for all the support and listening and getting in touch and just being involved in the show over the past couple of years.
For a little behind the scene here, for people who don't know, Mark and I do soccer coverage, and that's how I got all my equipment, so that it was easy to just start a Formula One podcast. So we can actually thank the world of soccer for both of us having the equipment needed to be able to do a Formula One show.
Well, we'd probably be doing the other shows separately, might I add. I think we've probably been doing that for, 2-3 years at least before we started the Formula One. So it was just basically setting up the feed and just making allotting time to do the Formula One. So it was a fairly easy transition to do it, and it's been an enjoyable one.
Speaking of enjoyable, this race was pretty enjoyable, even though there was no driver's championship has been wrapped up, but it was still interesting for a few little details. And of course, we'll get to the Verstappen Ocon incident. We'll talk about it in length. We'll see who's at fault, who's not, the pushing and shoving at the end, if it's good or not for Formula One. But I want to talk to you, Mark, about the performance of the Red Bull car to start it, the show. I was impressed by the speed of Verstappen and Ricciardo, if you look at it, in the entire race, how they were able to pick off the Ferraris and then the Mercedes, and Verstappen should have won this race. It's too bad the incident happened, but I'm still surprised by the development over the last few races now of the Red Bull car with the Renault engine. It's hard to imagine this improvement they have seen gonna translate next year with all the change in the engine and the MGUK, but still the development for Red Bull has been tremendous over the last few races.
Yeah, excuse me, absolutely, Kevin. And it really kind of makes me wonder, where's this performance in the Renault engine been for the past couple of years? I mean, they were miles ahead of everybody, literally, in the high altitude of Mexico City a couple of weeks ago. But going down to South America, to Interlagos at Sao Paulo, they were still extremely impressive. Of course, poor Danny Ricciardo fell foul of the gremlins once again and had to start with a grid penalty, which was unfortunate. Of course, he didn't finish the race before, but just in terms of pure power, it is very, very impressive. And it's all that more impressive that just how... Well, we know Red Bull has a good car, but just how much further ahead they are, of course, than McLaren, the other Renault-powered customer team, and then, of course, of the Renault factory team themselves. It's amazing. And now I kind of I'm just asking myself, and I'm sure a lot of people are asking the same questions: are they going to have similar success next year, going onto the Honda engine? But if you look at some of the other news around, Max Verstappen is saying that the Red Bull's absolutely not lying. That's the exact words that he used about the performance and the strides that Honda has made. So he really believes that they're going to be able to help them contend for a championship next year, which is a bit of a mind blower, but amazing if true.
Yeah, if true, that could be really impressive. If the rest of it, because we all know the improvement of this car. Yes, the Renault engine has been helpful, but it's not what really changed over the last few races, right? It's everything else surrounding it that allowed maybe the Red Bull to more efficiently channel that power of the Renault engine towards the wheels and make the car faster, and especially the grip. I think that's what the biggest improvement was with the Red Bull car over the last few weeks, especially in Mexico City and in Brazil, is the grip we've seen on that car. Both versus the Mercs and the Ferrari, you've seen a Red Bull car that has more grip and seemed maybe a bit easier to control on straight lines and on curves too. And you've seen Verstappen being able to overlap easily cars in a very small gap, but as well was able to overtake them in parts of the track that are maybe more dusty, a little less grippy, with less tire marbles on them. And we've seen Verstappen with the mechanical grip, what I feel it is, and not just aerodynamic, we've seen the car having more grip. So I think it's a little bit of a combination of the power, fine, but it's more how they process that tire and the suspension adjustment and the aerodynamics improvement. But I would not be surprised at all if the suspension and the traction of the car is due to a lot of work by the Red Bull crew for fixing and improving that suspension.
Yeah, absolutely. And Kevin, I'm just going to put this out here for you. Of course, this past weekend, Mercedes wrapped up the Constructors' Championship, which is their fifth in a row. And I think, although obviously it's an incredible achievement to win a Constructors' Championship, let alone multiple in a row, I think that years from now, people that didn't really sit through and watch the season closely might be a little bit misled at how close it was at times, and just might just kind of look, oh, well, that was the sort of peak Mercedes or whatever it might be, depending what happens over the next couple of seasons. But I mean, it really was a lot closer than that. I don't think it was really so cut and dry. But the thing is that Ferrari obviously was going back and forth with Mercedes up until, let's say, up until the summer break. Obviously, after Spa and Monza, that was the real turning point then in the season. And then when they went off form, they went off pretty quickly, and the change was pretty abrupt. However, I'm kind of wondering if an improved Red Bull team that is able to challenge more for race wins and be more of a competitor, more of a rival to the top two teams, is really what it's going to take to knock Mercedes off that pedestal or really make it a little bit more difficult from them. Because obviously it's been Ferrari that's taken the fight to them over the past couple of seasons. But I think if we're ever going to see a change in Formula One, unless Ferrari comes out and gets it right, or Red Bull comes and gets it right, or is able to beat Mercedes one-on-one, I just kind of wonder if maybe that's as well. It's obviously another possible scenario.
Right now, you know what it reminds me of? Maybe to a lesser extent, but it brings me back to the end of the 97th World Championship, Mark, where you had the Williams and the Ferraris battling for the world title and the constructor title, with the McLaren team getting really, really good late in the year. And this set up the dominance for the years to come after, with Mika Häkkinen and David Coulthard. I really feel this could be the case right here, where we see Red Bulls coming into coming of age in this second generation of success for the Red Bull crew after the Vettel years and those four championships. I think they're coming into a second wave of success that's going to come next year, but this year we're just seeing the progress and the hard work starting to pay off, and a little glimpse of maybe what we can see next year and the year after, with maybe Red Bull being the favorites week in, week out, and not just the Mercs. And I really, it feels like this to me, maybe not to the extent, but we'll see if they do get another result in the last Grand Prix of the season and maybe win it, then it will really feel like the end of 1997.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting, too, if you kind of go back to 2014 and the start of the turbo hybrid era. And you can really kind of, if you look at it back now, and obviously they have one more race left with Renault Power, and then they go into the new era with Honda for 2019. But it's interesting now with that you know, having that hindsight over the past couple of years, just how abrupt that change was and how drastic it was for Red Bull. Like you say, they won those four championships with Sebastian Vettel, and then all of a sudden, coming into the new the turbo hybrid era, that Renault engine obviously just did not have the power compared to, well, obviously Mercedes was the ones that got it right off of the bat, and then Ferrari slowly caught up, but they were even, you know, struggling, I think, a little bit right from the very beginning. And it's interesting, only I'd say in the latter half of this year that Renault power unit really seems to be making some strides. So we'll know this time next year whether the switch to the Honda engines was either an inspired move of genius or one of the biggest blunders ever in Formula One. I mean, there's a lot riding on it. I mean, considering how strong that they are finishing this season.
Yeah, if they do not carry over this momentum to next year, the first thing that people will point to is the Honda engine, right? It's like Honda doesn't have the benefit of the doubt anymore just because of the terrible years with McLaren over the last couple of years and with the lackluster performance of Toro Rosso this year. Not that the car hasn't been good. It has been good, but unfortunately the drivers were not able to get the most amount of points out of races, Brendan Hartley. And so that's where mostly of the blame is this year too, is that Honda part of the partnership that stands out. But if people are right in the Red Bull research and development area, maybe they do understand that the engine is going to be really powerful and they will be able to carry over that momentum. But that's the biggest question in the hierarchy of Formula One for next year, is where will Red Bull end up?
Yeah, well, I think if you're McLaren, they're probably hoping that things aren't going to go as quite as Red Bull is hoping, of course, because, I mean, they paid a lot of money to break that contract early after the end of last year, and they just haven't. Well, I mean, the McLaren is obviously the car itself is a big problem, but there is so much riding on it, and it's going to be a really, really interesting year next year. I mean, just from a lot of different perspectives, you know, the Red Bull Honda partnership is one. You have all the different changes in the teams with the drivers. You know, you got Charles Leclerc going to Ferrari. You have Kimi going the other way to Sauber. You have Mercedes staying the same. You know, can they keep going and keep dominating and win another championship or two? I mean, it's going to be really fascinating to see. And then, of course, there are still a couple of seats really up for grabs for next year that haven't been completely decided. But just to finish up on that one thought of yours, what you're just talking about the Toro Rosso's, they started pretty good. I mean, Gasly had an incredible race in Bahrain at the beginning of the year. But now you look at it, say, what, about like 18 races later, between Gasly and Brendan Hartley, they only have 33 points in the Constructors' Championship, which is only good enough for ninth, which puts them just ahead. Well, not just ahead, but, well, I mean, it's only Williams before them. And what makes that kind of interesting, too, is that the new Racing Point Force India, Mercedes or whatever they call themselves now, they have 48 points, and they basically had the slate wiped clean because all the points that they had accrued up until the first half of the season, until Lawrence Stroll and his consortium stepped in to buy the team and get them out of receivership, they forfeited all of those points. So that just really kind of puts that into perspective. And for me, what looked like a fairly promising season for Toro Rosso has kind of really fizzled out. I mean, they're, you know, several points behind Sauber, they've also fizzled out in the past several races. But again, interesting situations to watch for next season.
All right, let's move and let's dive right into it.
The juicy stuff.
Yes, exactly. Max Verstappen versus Esteban Ocon. By this point right now, you're all aware that Max Verstappen was leading the race, trying to pass, Ocon tried to unlap himself, it is more accurate. Verstappen was minding his own business, then Ocon comes into it and overtakes Verstappen to Verstappen's right on a left-hand corner, and then when it comes back to the right-hand corner right after it into a type of S right there, while Ocon was inside, Verstappen didn't leave any space for both cars, so they touched. Fortunately, Verstappen was able to continue and finish second, but unfortunately for Max, he was overtaken by Lewis Hamilton with a subsequent little delay of spinning out and coming back into the track. Lewis Hamilton overtook him. Lewis Hamilton got the win, got the fifth straight Constructors' Championship for Mercedes. But with this move, Max Verstappen's reputation takes a hit. And speaking of taking a hit, back in the paddock after the race, Max Verstappen confronted Esteban Ocon and shoved him. And the shove apparently was a reaction and triggered. Literally, Verstappen was triggered by Ocon's words and reaction. And yes, it's a lot of drama, a lot of controversy. I felt like I was watching NASCAR for a second.
Well, yeah, it was pretty much a ridiculous situation. And I mean, I completely understand that Esteban Ocon has the right to unlap himself. But don't race with the race leader and don't do it in the corner that he did it in. And yeah, I mean, you can make the argument that that Max should have given him more room going through that that first series of corners there at Interlagos. But still, I don't think he expected Ocon to still be racing side by side with him. And
true.
I mean, his reaction when he got punted off the track there coming out of turn two was immediate. And it was he was very, very upset, as you would well expect. But the one thing that I was surprised at is the damage that Max sustained during that that crash with Ocon. Is if you just look behind the side pod on the right-hand side of the car, is just where it sort of tapers in when it just goes around the back of the radiators, is the floor there was actually quite badly damaged and broken. And I think Max had said something fairly quickly over the radio back to the pit saying that he had sustained floor damage. But I think at that time, I can't remember the exact lead he had over Lewis. I'm thinking somewhere between 4.5 and 6 seconds. So, I mean, he had a comfortable gap that if everything had stayed the same, I would have expected that it would have he would have maintained that lead, if not extended it a little bit in the final segment of that race. But, of course, in the time that he was off the track and then getting back up to speed, and then, you know, getting back, just, you know, working out the frustrations, just focusing back on the race itself. He ended up a similar distance, I think, behind Lewis. And what I was surprised to see is despite that damage that he had to the floor of his car, by the end of the race, he was able to basically close that gap. I mean, he wasn't close enough to challenge him, but at the end of the race, I mean, Max was only a second and a half behind. I mean, if that race went another 10 laps, I think, despite the damage to his car, I think Max was racing with about 50 extra horsepower, which was just the steam coming out of his ears after the accident. But, you know, that's just talking about the aftermath of it. It wasn't a good look. I can completely understand Max's reaction, and although maybe it would have been better for him to restrain himself and not lash out once, not twice, but three times to push Ocon. I mean, Ocon was just kind of standing there and grinning and just kind of like not apologizing for anything. I mean, the guy was not in contention, and I really believe that. If you want to put some blame on Max for not leaving enough room going into turn two, that's fine. But I think that the majority of that blame has to fall on Esteban Ocon's shoulders.
Well, I agree. And when I say not enough room, I have to explain myself. I'm basically taking maybe the same stance as Lewis Hamilton did in that little room after when the top three drivers are talking to each other. Like, yes, he's allowed to unlap himself. That's well and fine. He has nothing to lose. You're the race leader. So it's the same thing of when you have a big brother and a smaller brother. Yeah, the smaller brother did start the fight, but did you have to punch him back? You're the older brother. You should know better, and you should maybe be a bit more conservative at that moment. And that's what maturity will give Verstappen on the track. And that maturity will be eventually, the next time it happens, you just let the guy go. Just because, you know what, I'm not going to risk a win for this. Let the guy by you, and you can probably overtake him in the next few laps if you need to, or just run your own race when you have nothing to lose at that point for him. If you actually try to stop from overtaking you and try to play it risky, you do have a lot to lose, and that's maybe the stance that I'm taking. I am blaming Ocon for the touch and for the risk that Esteban Ocon did do. But for Max Verstappen, he needs to have the maturity to understand that even if he lets him by, there's no foul there. There's no risk, and he's actually less risk than if he tries to close the door. So I think that's where it's important for Verstappen is, you know, you had a lot to lose by just trying to hold the point or to hold the argument. And maybe next time you'll be a bit more conservative in how you handle your car when you're leading with 30 laps to go.
Well, I think that's also part of the process of him maturing as a driver, because as ridiculous as it seems to suggest that a Force India could unlap themselves from a Mercedes, but just to switch that Red Bull with, say, Lewis Hamilton, and if Lewis was in that same situation, I would just I can't imagine a scenario that he wouldn't give way or find a way to preserve the car and, you know, maybe react with some sort of indignity or outrage over the radio. It's like, what the hell is this guy doing? But first and foremost, protecting the car, protecting the lead, and making sure that you come home in first place. And because it's a different situation, it would be different if going into turn one, Ocon breaks himself and slams up the rear end of Max Verstappen's gearbox, very much like we saw with Verstappen and Ricciardo at Baku early in the year. That's a little bit different. Then you can put that 100% on Ocon in that situation. But, you know, like I say, I mean, going into those corners, you can really... That's why I say I think maybe call it 95-5 or 90-10, 85-15, depending on your point of view where the blame lays. But I couldn't see Lewis doing the same thing. And I guess that explains why Lewis said, you know, he didn't really point fingers one way or another and just sort of labeled it as a racing incident, albeit an unfortunate one if you're Max Verstappen.
Yeah, exactly. And Lewis Hamilton was literally like, yeah, he had the right to unlap himself. And you had the right to react the way you do. But if it would have been me, I would have just reacted differently. And he says, like, he literally said to Max Verstappen, he had nothing to lose. You did. And he was basically saying, you know what? Even though it's his fault and all, you're like the cyclist versus a car on the road. As much as sometimes you're mad at the car because he's always cutting you and not supposed to do so, you're on a car and you're on a bike. If you brake earlier, the car passes by, he doesn't hit you, you're not going to have a broken leg. If you're trying to hold your ground and to argue with the car, you might have a broken leg. So, you know, that's what happens anyway.
Yeah, but, you know, just talking about reactions, you know who was not quite so restrained in commenting on the...
Let me guess. 1997 world champion.
That's it. Jacques Villeneuve himself basically said that the whole situation and what Ocon did was an embarrassment. And, you got to respect Jacques. I mean, he doesn't mince words. He calls it like he sees it. And, you know, just the whole situation was not a good look for Formula One. Just what happened on the track and off the track. But he even went a little bit further just to explain or broaden that discussion, not just to what happened at the Interlagos this past weekend, but some of the situations that we've seen over the past couple of years. Most notably last year would be several of the incidents that he had with his teammate Sergio Perez, which eventually led to almost the unprecedented action by Force India to ban the two teammates from racing one another because of it was becoming too costly. I mean, there was several that you could look at, but good old JV, never one to mince words, eh?
No, of course. And I do have the aspect of boy crying wolf a bit too hard, too often. So whenever he speaks, as much as he's my favorite driver of all time, I still take his comments with a grain of salt because he does this to get reaction and it still works. And that's why he's still involved in the world of Formula One. And that's why he's paid to give his opinion on races. But he does have a point, though. If you're Esteban Ocon and you are trying to be in the good graces of anyone out there with a seat available, it's not the best way possible to have a controversy in your second to last race this year in Formula One, and who knows what the future has in store. So if you're Esteban Ocon, as much as you want to prove yourself and you want to unlap your car to maybe get the best result possible, creating this controversy is not helping his cause, I believe.
No, I don't know, just to sort of change the topic slightly here. I don't know if you saw the press conference or the interview afterwards. There are some unedited versions floating around on social media, but Max was asked what he thought of the whole incident, what led to the shoving incident in Parc Fermé, and Max basically said, well, he was acting like a pussy.
He said he was acting like one after too, because he wouldn't get into a fight, I guess, with Verstappen.
Well, what was amusing about that whole situation is when the camera pans out, I'm pretty sure I saw a pretty big grin and a smirk on Kimi Raikkonen's face, sitting two places to the left of Max Verstappen. But now even, just to keep sort of dragging this one out, but Ross Brawn, the motorsport director at Formula One, he said that Max has to learn to rein in his emotions, which is basically what we were talking about.
It's true, right?
Yeah. Well, I think Max, he is showing that he has all the traits to be a Formula One world champion. And having that passion and that energy like that he has, that's not a bad thing. It's just channeling it and focusing it and expressing it in the right and proper moments.
Yeah, I call it dialing it down. Now he's still driving 100%, right? He's driving 100% of his capabilities every single time he's in the car. If he wants to become the next Lewis Hamilton, maybe. Or maybe he wants to be the first Max Verstappen, granted. But Lewis Hamilton does not drive 100% of the car all the time. He drives at 92, 93%. Because he dials it down a bit to be a bit more conservative, because you win a world championship over the season, not every single lap you're racing. And I guess this what will come with Verstappen controlling his emotion is dialing down it a bit, dialing it down the emotional responses by just a few percentage, and then you'll get the result maybe over a long period of time.
Yeah, Formula One is all about pushing things to the limit and driving on the edge, but at certain times, that there is, like you say, there you can't go out 100% all the time. For various reasons, you're gonna ruin your tires, you're gonna put the equipment too hard, and then just the mental aspect of it too, driving at that sort of limit the entire times. It's just it just does not seem like a sustainable kind of things, and I think that's what makes Lewis so good, and other drivers of that stature, is that you can still be fast and still be accomplishing what you need to be, but you're not at the ragged edge, you're as close as you need to be and still be in control. And I think that's just as difficult as it must feel for Max right now. It is one of those things that he has to learn. We forget that he's still only 21 years old. And he didn't really have that much time in the junior formulas to learn some of these things. So a lot of the development that we've seen over Max Verstappen over the past couple of years since he's been in Formula One, and then, of course, making the jump from Toro Rosso to the Red Bull senior team, is that he's basically kind of been figuring it out as he's been going along. And, of course, we saw earlier this year that it took him a good half a dozen races really to get things figured out, because I think we had this discussion about the patience and the focus earlier in the year, especially when he put it into the barriers at Monaco in FP3, and that was the real turning point, because after that we saw Max come to Canada a couple of weeks later and be more focused, and the Max Verstappen after the sixth race of the season, whatever it was in Monaco up until this weekend, has been a completely different Max Verstappen. He's been more focused, he's been quick, he's been doing all the right things, and unfortunately this past weekend he did one little thing that's kind of wasn't really all his fault.
He could have reacted better, but I agree with you. Yeah. It's not his fault. The incident happened and that wasn't his fault, but the reaction and the shoving at the end was. So I guess that's where we're at. It wasn't his fault. That's why Verstappen did not have a penalty during the race, which Ocon did. Ocon did have a stop and go 10-second penalty. And that's, that's where, if the Formula One actually stands on this, and the commissaire of the track were like, yeah, it's Ocon's fault, but the Formula One drama that happened in the paddock, the pushing and shoving. This is not something that they want to see. Or do is it? It's like it's new owners. It's being talked about everywhere now. So maybe they don't hate it anymore. I don't know.
Is it a case that there's no such thing as bad press? Because, I mean, for better or worse, I mean, and I mean, it wasn't like they were throwing haymakers at each other there.
No, exactly. It was a very conservative shoving. Like, I've seen worse in the metro yesterday when I was walking, you know, so we see a lot worse all the time.
I've seen worse going into the coffee shop to get my coffee in the morning, and the people that they're jonesing off of their last coffee fix or, you know, throwing elbows trying to get their coffee. But yeah, you know, I guess it all comes down to a question of sportsmanship. And, you know, honestly, it didn't bother me all that much to be truthful, because I think it was just an emotional reaction in a heated situation. I mean, Max obviously could have reacted better. Ocon probably could have said or behaved a little bit different, because I think that Max obviously was heated going into the park for May. You knew at some point that they were going to run into each other, and I think Max even said at some point, you know, that there's always that opportunity to talk and discuss these things. But I think it was Ocon's reaction to him, and just the fact that he wasn't going to back down and was rather indignant, that really set him off, and it's earned him 2 days community service as punishment from the FIA. So I don't know what that is. To
I'll sign autographs, maybe be like, make sure you come into the Grand Prix 2 days earlier. You'll have a little booth where the public can come and see and get your autograph. But just to go back to, I think it was premeditated though, because when you hear Verstappen when he's late in the race, he's like, yeah, I just hope I can find him in the paddock after the race, in the back fermé. So just with that comment, like, yeah, that's probably why he got the 2 days public service, because his violence towards Ocon was premeditated, because he was already looking forward for the race to be over just to find Esteban.
Well, it was very much like a throwback to an earlier era. I mean, we go back to, what was it, Spa 1998, when a slow-moving David Coulthard, or I should say a Michael Schumacher, collided with a slow-moving David Coulthard in the rain at Spa and took the one side of his car off when he was miles ahead in that race. Anyways, then they went back to the pits, and Schumacher stormed down to the McLaren garage, and there was a big pushing match down there. And of course, that was something that happened with Senna. And I think that even at one point, Nigel Mansell went after Senna. You know, it's nothing new. And I mean, I don't think that anybody should overlook incidents like that. I mean, in a one-off situation like that, it's not a big deal to me. I mean, it, like I say, it's not really the greatest look for the sport. And I think that should something ever happen like that again, I think that Max is probably going to, I would hope that he would be the bigger fellow and keep his emotions in check. But obviously, it did end or did lend to some sort of extra spice to the race, and a discussion that we don't usually have in Formula One.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It'll be fun. We'll see where this all goes. And again, like you mentioned earlier, it is a learning process for Verstappen. He probably learned a lot of things too in the whole dealings of this. But you know what I thought was interesting is, let me just see who said that comment. But some people see in Verstappen and his response and his reactions to what's going on a bit of a throwback to, like you mentioned, an older era. It's Senna-esque, as we could say.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that Damon Hill had made that comment that incident reminded him of Senna, and of course he would have been around in that era with at Senna at the end. And you know, it's interesting. You know, you get these comparisons. I mean, you know, with Max being sort of like Senna in multiple ways. I mean, Senna, of course, was one of the greatest drivers in the wet, and Max has proven that that he's also he's obviously the best driver of this current generation in the wet. So these comparisons for the right and maybe the not so right reasons are maybe a little bit concerning, depending which way you look at it. But it's interesting nonetheless. But it's also just, I mean, the amount of like discussion that this has also generated was not just what happened between the two of them, but the immediate reaction that came out afterwards is sort of these conspiracy tinfoil hat theories that, of course, that it was some sort of premeditated ordered thing that because, you know, Force India being a Mercedes-powered car had... You know, there was some sort of conspiracy there that and him being a Mercedes junior driver that there was some sort of nefariousness going on there, which is preposterous to say the least.
Right, the risk involved, just the risk involved. Exactly. Imagine something goes wrong, someone gets injured, or a car crashes, and you know, you never know what can happen when a car crashes. Can you imagine if it's known that it was deliberate? No, it's like no one will ever take such a risk just to secure a constructors' championship that you would have gotten anyways. No, it's conspiracies at this level where you need more than two people to agree to do something. It never exists because people never agree on stuff, and no one would have ever agreed to pull this off.
Well, you know, the funny thing about that is, I mean, like, how did that go down? Did it happen? Did Toto Wolff, like, text Otmar Szafnauer over at Force India and say, yeah, take Max out the first chance you get? I mean, just when you kind of even just sort of vocalize it, I mean, it sounds ridiculous to the extreme. But, you know, just sort of talking a little bit more about Mercedes now, the one thing that surprised me was that Hamilton apparently at one point was faced with what Mercedes had called was imminent engine failure at the Brazilian Grand Prix. And basically, I think it was about it was somewhere between lap 25 and 30 where the engineers had basically they were having a discussion, and it came over the radio network in the Mercedes pits that Hamilton's engine was overheating. It was operating beyond the upper level safe limit, and they expected that engine to fail within a lap or two. And obviously that didn't happen, and I had to chuckle afterwards about what I'd called Lewis Hamilton's almost unholy good luck. You know, I mean, first of all, he benefits from that tangle between Verstappen and Ocon, and then you hear this afterwards that his engine had failed or was about to fail only about a third or a quarter of the way into the race, and he still goes on to win the thing. I mean, talk about a guy that's got the golden touch. But you know, it goes back to that old saying: when you're hot, you're hot, right?
Yeah, and when you have good luck, luck follows you around. Yeah. And I think 2018 and 2017 are Lewis Hamilton's. When did Rosberg win? Was it 2017, 2016?
2016, yeah.
2016, and yeah. So the last 2 years, Hamilton won with a lot of luck, too. 2016, he ran out of luck all season long, too. But, you know, maybe he's going to run out of luck for next year, Hamilton. And maybe he's actually... emptying all the good luck karma he has this year, and next year maybe Verstappen will get that good luck, and you never know. I still feel like it might be a three horse race next year, and Red Bull might be the best of them three. We'll see. It depends on how Verstappen and Gasly can actually work together.
Yeah, that's going to be an interesting dynamic. But just to finish up that thought you were making about Lewis Hamilton, I think that finally when Lewis decides to call it a career, I mean, I don't think he's the kind of guy that'll keep racing forever and ever just to sort of pad his own numbers. I think when the time comes, he'll be ready to walk away. And if the luck's run out by then, I'm pretty sure Lewis can take a look back and say, yeah, you know what? I had a pretty good run when I was driving in Formula One. The different race wins, the championships, and everything that he's achieved, and I mean he's blown the pole position record out of the water. I mean he beat Schumacher's record Senna's record over a year ago, and then Schumacher's, and then I mean he just keeps going and going and going. So he'll own that record, which I am sure will stand for a very very long time until somebody else equals it.
Yeah, we'll stay probably, I don't know, in perpetuity. We never know. But to finish on Hamilton, he won 50 of 99 races in the turbo hybrid era for Lewis Hamilton. So that's more than 50% of the race he has taken under a hybrid era. So that was with turbo and hybrid era. So that was with Mercedes, basically, since, 2012, 2013? So
yeah, something like that. Yeah,
yeah, 2013. Yeah, so 99 races, about 6 years. That's what it been. That's what it would be. So not too bad. Not too bad for Hamilton.
Yeah, he's definitely had a pretty decent run over the past several years. And of course, I don't know if you saw it too, they did replay some of those highlights from 2008 when Felipe Massa was world champion for about 30 seconds until Lewis crossed the finish line just in the position that he needed to just to sneak that world championship away from him, which had to be one of the most exciting climaxes and finales to a world championship in recent memories. Of course, that 2 years ago in Abu Dhabi on the final race of the year, what with Rosberg kind of just managing those pass or the last couple of Grand Prix, and then Lewis leading that race and kind of you know, backing him into Verstappen and Vettel behind them. That that was rather dramatic as well, but I still think that was second seat to the whole Massa Hamilton first world championship. I mean,
oh, yeah.
Felipe had that one and then had it evaporate and slip through his fingers. I mean, that must have been, I can't imagine what he must have felt after
it's
that.
It's as close as he ever got, right? It's as close as being world champion as he ever got, just a few laps away.
Well, he was never officially world champion, Kevin, but he was a world champion 30 seconds longer than either of us will ever be. So he could at least say that much.
That's true. That's true. All right. When we start to wrap up the show here, just a few notes. You mentioned Hamilton imminent engine failure that happened. Ferrari revealed that they had sensor problem hurting Vettel's race. And if you look at the race itself, maybe that does explain the lack of, I wouldn't say the lack of speed, but the lack of commitment from Vettel and Raikkonen to their position and to pushing forward. They were content with their position, pushing whenever they could, but they knew Verstappen was not going to be catched, and they didn't even try to. So maybe that does reveal that reaction towards their car.
Yeah, and it was interesting, too, because even though Verstappen was able to get around Bottas, Raikkonen, especially after the pit stops, looked like he was going to get around Bottas, and you know, in short order. But it was also you know, the team orders thing was interesting to see, because it was obvious that Kimi had the faster of the two Ferraris on the day, and when the order came through to let Raikkonen pass so he could have a go at Bottas when he had the fresh rubber as well, was interesting. And you could see the replay when they showed Arriva Bene on the pit wall just making that sort of hand motion to switch the two, and Vettel, I think he knew. I mean, his car just he almost stalled off of the line on the formation lap. It looked like the anti-stall device had sort of kicked in, because when they started to pull away from the start and finish there to form up for the race itself, he really struggled to get the car off of the line there. So who knows if that was all part of the same thing, but it was just sort of an anticlimactic race, I thought, for him. I mean, obviously, he's had his struggles, which are well documented at this point in time, but there was still that opportunity for Ferrari to win the Constructors' Championship in the last two races, although obviously it was a really big hill to climb, but it was almost an anticlimactic, and I wouldn't say half-hearted measure or half-hearted effort. I don't think that was that was it at all. But they clearly once again weren't a match for Mercedes, or at least for Hamilton. Bottas obviously didn't quite have the performance or the result that he needed in Brazil either.
Yeah. No. Exactly. And now another little tidbit of news. Rob Smedley, formerly of Williams, is talking to other F1 team for another F1 role, but his last stint with Williams did not help his reputation. So I'm wondering what role would he have with the team, and it wouldn't be close to anything that he wished he would have, which was team director. He was being literally groomed for that, and now it's not going to be the case, I feel.
Well, yeah, you know, when you look at how quickly they've really fallen off, I mean, they've lost their way big time just in the past couple of seasons. And what with Paddy Lowe going there after 2016, leaving Mercedes, that is, to join Williams at that role there, and Smedley heading up, what was it, the vehicle performance director role or something to that effect. I mean, it really looked like that they had some good pieces in place there, and obviously, I mean, they've gone backwards and dropped like a lead balloon. So it's not really a good thing to have on your resume. But I mean, he's been in F1 for a while, so it'll be interesting to see where he pops up. But talking about things popping up, the new FIA crash response system made its F1 debut in Brazil. A lot of the details haven't been released. They'll make that known over time, but it's more of an automated system that the first responders will use when coming to a crash or an incident at a race. And apparently saying that a lot of the data on what's happened in the accident can be transmitted without without voice and different ways. It can be transmitted automatically, basically, is what it is. And they're saying that even a time saving of 10 to 20 seconds can make a big difference. So that'll be interesting to see what exactly and how the system works in greater detail once they sort of finalize it and make it public. But yeah, just goes to show you again, Kevin, just how there are so many aspects of Formula One that are completely high tech and space age nowadays, and it's in every aspect of the sport.
Yeah, no, I agree, and we maybe keep the last one for our next show because we'll need things to talk about probably for the next race, and that's interesting because it's a whole conversation about what's good for one team versus good for the entirety of the grid. And so, but I want to leave you with this, Mark. You know what's going to happen in 2019? You remember what 2017 got me all excited about? Well, 2019, it will happen again. Fernando Alonso back at Indianapolis for the Indy 500 and with McLaren too.
Yeah, it's that's like a story that just never seems to go away. And it'll be interesting to see Fernando at Indy. I mean, he did really amazing last year in his first crack at it, and unfortunately when did his engine blow up? It wasn't too far from the end. It was
like a little
20 30 laps left in the 500,
something like that. It was maybe three quarters of the race in.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the 500 is a real tough test, well, for many reasons, not just on the cars and the drivers, and it was just unfortunate. I mean, he had just had a fantastic month there, just in testing, the rookie day, qualifying, the race itself. I mean, he just looked like a guy that looked almost instantly comfortable driving that Andretti Honda around the around Indianapolis. And well, I mean, there is no doubt about how good of a driver Fernando Alonso is. I mean, his legacy in Formula One, I think, is tarnished by I think a litany of what ifs. Who knows whether he got the best advice? Perhaps he was just it was more his personality and his nature that got him into the situations and the bridges that were burned. But definitely, if there is a guy that can win the Triple Crown and be the first guy to do it since Graham Hill, who won Monaco, Indianapolis, and Le Mans, I'd put my money on Fernando. So,
well, he only needs Indy because he won Le Mans this year. So that's a big difference since the last time he went to Indy. Is this time he's got Le Mans too? So,
yeah,
we'll see. That could be done this year. But what I find fascinating is he going to do more than just one race? That's a question, because his calendar is quite open next year, so he might have more time to do more than one race.
Well, that's right, and the thing is that Fernando keeps saying that, you know, I'm a racer, I love to race, and I love going out there each and every weekend. So I think he's one of those guys that if he's still enjoying it, and as long as he's competitive, be it in endurance cars, be it in Indy, whatever he chooses, I think as long as he's having fun and he's got a good car, then I think we'll see Fernando Alonso around for a while yet. Maybe he'll become the next AJ Foyt or Mario Andretti. I mean, because they raced for quite a long time. I mean, I can still remember when Mario was racing in an Indy car. I mean, that was what, probably
mid-90s. Yeah. I remember. I've seen like two Andretti race at the same time. So, yeah, it must have been like 94, 95.
Yeah, that would sound about right. I mean, even at that time, Mario was quite salt and peppered, and I mean, he'd been around for quite a while, but it's true.
He more, was raised more at the
same
salt.
Time Michael was.
Salt and pepper, I would say, probably a lot more salt, though, than pepper, yeah. So he was up there. But no, you're right. Absolutely. All right. As always, Mark, where can we find your personal work, and where can we follow you on social media?
You can follow me on social media on Twitter at MarkJRDaily, and that's Mark with a K and a Daily with an EY at the end. And you can follow this show also on Twitter at ScuderiaF1Pod, and we also have a Facebook page, facebook.com/ScuderiaF1Pod.
Thanks for the follow. I'm at Kev Larame, and as always, until next time, have a great Formula One.
Thanks for listening to the Scuderia F1 podcast. If you want to get the show notes for this episode, then head over to ScuderiaF1Pod.com. Want to get in touch with us? Then email us at ScuderiaF1Pod@gmail.com.